One thing that I like to say a lot, in fact, I think I even said it on our very first show, is that money is a lens, a window into the choices we make, whether we have to, because after all, money is limited, or want to, as individuals, families, countries, societies. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And this was one of those weeks, because if you think about it, a president's budget request is exactly that, a list of choices, and we're going to dig into it. Plus, we are talking about what kind of healthcare we're willing to pay for, and even individual choices, like whether you use a ride-sharing app or hail a taxi. As always, you can come talk to me or the team about our show, or, you know, policy choices, whatever, at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We're going to start the show this week, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week are Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, and Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Hey.
I want to start, Neil, with your long, because it's one of those things that kind of makes people's eyeballs glaze over. Not mine, of course. Never mind. And I need you to explain your long and why I should actually pay attention.
I am long interest rates. The Federal Reserve, as was widely reported, raised its interest rate target back on Wednesday. Look, normally the Fed does its thing. It's very technical. Who cares? But I think what we've really seen is this important shift coming out of the Federal Reserve in the last few weeks. They're ready to not just do this very, you know, narrow playing with the dial on the money supply. They're saying it's time to move toward a more normal environment. And that includes higher interest rates from these compared to these zero interest rates we've had for all these years.
But
well,
why does that matter?
But I care.
You care? Well, that's good.
You know, I'm a homeowner and was thinking about refinancing. So I think that's the national divide on whether people care about interest rates.
Okay, so you just gave us one example, which is the one that comes up a lot, which is, okay, if you have a mortgage, this is going to be important for you. I guess, Neil, I'm curious about that, both on the consumer side, like Ina mentioned, if you have a mortgage, if you have a credit card, et cetera. But then on the other kind of economic policy side, because it also seemed to me, like listening to Janet Yellen and reading the tea leaves a little bit, that the Fed, you know, they have this new role in economic policymaking that is sort of acting like a counterweight or, a counterbalance to whatever is happening on the fiscal side with Congress and the White House.
Yeah, look, Janet Yellen and the Fed, they're in a position they haven't been for years and years. And it's actually normal in the longer sweep of things, but they're actually worried about the economy overheating. They're actually worried about inflation getting too high. And, you know, for the better part of a decade, we've been in the opposite of that world. We've been in a world where inflation is too low, where growth is too low. Now, what they're starting to worry about is, you know, we're at 4.7% unemployment. What if we get some fiscal stimulus, we get tax cuts, maybe a little infrastructure, though we'll talk about that in a little bit. You know, are we really in a world where we're trying to grow the economy faster than it's possible to grow? And if that happens, we'll just get inflation. The Fed's actually worried about that. Again, I wouldn't have said that for most of the last decade.
You know, I want to flip to year long a little bit because we're talking about an economic reality and see what I did there. Why don't you go
you did. That's
with
impressive.
Your yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's my job. Tell me what you're long.
So I am log augmented reality. So not the concept of virtual reality, although I think that's plenty fun and will be interesting for some things. That's where you strap on a headset and kind of, you know, leave your world entirely. I'm actually longer augmented reality, which is a little bit of fantasy on top of actual reality. So a really bad example is Google Glass. So you're getting a little bit of display in front of your real world. There have been only early stabs at this. But a lot of people, whether it's Tim Cook at Apple or Bill Gates, have said they really see this as the game changer. So the dream scenario is you sort of have something in your ear. You walk up. It's that person. You're like, I know them. Where do I know them from? And instead of having that awkward moment, your little earpiece tells you it's the person you were on Marketplace with. And I'm like, oh, yeah, of course it is.
Wow.
Hi, Neil. Great to see you again.
Let me ask you from a consumer standpoint, like, okay, the business case, I can totally see. That makes sense. From a consumer standpoint, what am I talking about here? Like, what is this going to cost me?
you know, just like with virtual reality, you have everything from cardboard, which, you know, houses your phone and costs almost nothing, to separate, you know, VR headsets. I think you're going to see similar in augmented reality, where I think for consumers, you know, the basic applications are going to be on your phone. So I think some of this will come very inexpensively. I think then others of it will require glasses, you know, specialized things. I saw a demo, and it was mostly vaporware, but a really cool demo from Cooper Mini, the unit of BMW, where you could wear glasses while you were driving. And when you go to park, you could actually see the curb. And the way it was doing that was it had a camera that was on the outside of the car looking towards the curb. And when you look down to park, you suddenly see the curb. That would require glasses and being built into your car. That's a really expensive scenario. I think we'll see everything in between.
So that's completely amazing to me. But when you think about the sort of extraneous parts of tech that come into our lives, I want to stay with you because you are also going short something in the tech world. And it's one thing where I feel like I have seen like, yeah, this just hasn't really hit, at least for me. Tell me about your short.
So I am short smartwatches. I do think we're going to have more and more digital things in our life. But I have yet to see the compelling case, particularly for a screen on my wrist. I think there's a lot of benefit in having some health sensors around. I think people are into tracking fitness and sleep, and I see that actually getting much smaller so that you don't have to wear a big wristbandy thing. But I'm not so far convinced that we need a screen on our wrists. So far, it just seems to be what's in a smartphone, what can we shrink down and put on a wrist. It's not very compelling. I get to try all these out. I typically try them out for a couple days, then they sit for a while. Even the Apple Watch, which is probably the most refined, even when I'm wearing it just because I want to play Pokemon Go, I can only seem to remember it, you know, one day out of two. So I'm just not convinced yet. I think the one thing that would make me longer is if we start to see health applications, if it can really make me healthier. And I don't mean telling me I should eat better and take more steps. I actually know that without wearing a device. I mean, it's monitoring my heart. It's alerting to life-threatening things. I think that's the one area. But again, I think this could show up as sensors and get sent to your phone versus needing to be another screen and a screen on your wrist.
All right, Neil, let's go with your short here because it does fit into this broader picture of kind of overall economic growth. When we're thinking about things from a consumer perspective, you know, that Dina's talking about, and then thinking about things from a macro perspective when you were referencing Janet Yellen. Tell me about your short.
So I am short infrastructure. If you remember the morning after the election, the first thing Donald Trump talked about was doing major infrastructure spending, roads, bridges, power lines, you name it. You know, the number tossed around was $1 trillion. If that were to happen, it would be a big boost to America's physical infrastructure, set the stage for long-term growth. There could be a lot of gains from doing that. The thing that's happened since then is basically nothing. There's been nothing out of the administration on what they want to do, how they want to pay for it, how they want to organize it, how they want to get it through Congress. And, you know, in Washington, we're 2 months into the administration. Obviously, it's still early, but things have kind of a half-life in Washington. And if there's no momentum behind something, if there's no activity happening to really, put the bones on a policy to really figure out the details, that's kind of the same as not happening at all.
Well, it's not even something we've seen in the president's budget request, which we're going to get into later in the show. But you would think that if this is where you were going, you would maybe put an infrastructure-related blueprint in the wish list of things you're telegraphing to the rest of the country.
That's right.
Unless infrastructure counts as, you know, a border wall or a new bomber. That seems to be the only piece of infrastructure that we are getting. But it's not what Neil's talking. It's not the kind of thing that would put a lot of people to work. It's also not the thing that I think, and this is what Neil was getting at, that would provide the long-term benefits of, you know, you build that road and there's a short-term benefit of, you know, the economic stimulus of building that road, the people that have to build that road, the companies that build that road. But then you have this half-life of everyone driving down that road. And the kind of infrastructure we're talking about, even to the degree it creates jobs, doesn't have any of that half-life. So if let's say, and there's no clear plan of how, you know, we would build this wall that Mexico's not paying for, but even if you did that, it's hard to imagine a lot of economic activity being generated. If anything, economic activity is being blocked.
Maybe if you're a construction worker by the border, you have work, but for everybody else, it doesn't do a whole lot. The other lesson here is that The Republican Congress has had every opportunity for the last 8 years under the Obama administration. If they wanted to make infrastructure happen, they could have signed on. President Obama would have signed it in a minute. They could have dictated the terms and what types of projects, how they're funded. They didn't do that. Republicans in Congress are not that enthusiastic about heading this direction. They have the majority. If they don't want to do it, Trump can't force them to.
Neil Irwin from The New York Times, Ina Fried from Axios, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks.
Of our numbers here at Marketplace, kind of our thing, what we do. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Tony Wagner and Sarah Menendez as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$10.4 billion.
That's how much Americans are expected to bet on the March Madness college basketball tournament this year, according to the American Gaming Association.
It's a big number, but with an average bet of $29, hopefully the losers won't be too put out.
The whole pool altogether is up 13% from last year, and that includes office pools, offshore sports books, and local bookmakers.
Only 3% of March Madness betting is believed to be legally wagered.
$200.
That's the price of a new smart hairbrush released by L'Oreal.
The brush has a built-in microphone that analyzes your brushing patterns so you don't overbrush.
It even measures the force you're putting on your scalp. And it connects to an app, of course.
Of course. This is just one of many new tech products beauty companies have been putting out.
$52.5 billion.
That's how much Disney made in retail sales in 2015. The last year data is available.
New live-action adaptations of classic animated movies like Beauty and the Beast are giving the brand's merchandise a new target audience beyond children, adult women.
Home Shopping Network is partnering with Disney to sell to millennial moms. Think Le Creuset soup pots, Swarovski jewelry, and Vince Camuto shoes.
Sales driven by nostalgia? It's a tale as old as time.
Remember last week when we talked to Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein about the new healthcare bill? Well, now we know more about the American Healthcare Act and the policy choices it makes. Dan is at the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
So last week there were a lot of details we didn't know. For this week's update, there's a lot more. First off, we got a score from the Congressional Budget Office to translate into English. That's a price tag. Why does that matter to, you know, someone who's sitting around saying, like, what's the impact on me and my family?
Right. So there are a couple of things that this whole plan, sometimes being called now the Ryan Plan, is all about. And it's really about the size of tax credits that people will get to help them buy insurance if they don't get insurance through their jobs. And the other piece is around Medicaid. And so we got a couple of big numbers. I'm going to keep this simple. And we're going to talk about what, you know, you talked about the score, the cost of this. And basically, the big numbers are 24 million people over the next decade would lose insurance. That's both people who buy insurance on the exchanges right now. That's people who get insurance through work. Another big number is $337 billion over the next decade. That's how much the federal deficit would go down. So if you're worried about how much you're paying in taxes, this might be a way to lower how much you pay in taxes. Third number is $880 billion. That's how much the Medicaid program would be cut. That's the health program for low-income people, seniors, people who are on disability, and disabled Americans. And then, Lizzie, the biggest number is uncountable, and that's the number of critics this plan has. Mm. I mean, the left, the right, the middle, lots of people do not like this plan.
Well, because a lot of people don't like it, where are the areas that we could see compromise? After all, you know, most finished products at the end process on Capitol Hill do not look like the original ones.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of talk. There's lots of movement in Congress right now. I think one of the areas where we're likely to see compromise, this Ryan plan repealed the individual mandate, the requirement that people buy insurance. The idea is to replace it with a plan where if you lapse and don't have insurance for 2 months or longer, you could be charged a sort of a surcharge. And I think there's a lot of movement, people talking about doing away with that. There's a lot of talk about basically making deeper cuts to Medicaid in one way or another, maybe even work requirements or having people look for work on Medicaid. So if you're on Medicaid and you're listening to this, that's something you should probably be thinking about. And then maybe even more generous subsidies for people who are a little older. You know, Lizzie, if you compare the tax credits that people are getting right now under the Affordable Care Act, it's a lot closer to how much it actually costs compared to what people are proposing in this Ryan plan. If the Ryan plan were to go through, people would have to come up with thousands and thousands of dollars more than they do right now to get health insurance. And that's really a real sticking point for lots of people.
You're a healthcare reporter. You watch all sorts of weird little details more closely than other people. What are the kind of secret signals you are watching?
Well, I think I was talking to a source a couple of days ago, and my source recommended watch the Senate. I think that the House is coming up with a plan that is really one way to think about this is it's the beginning of a negotiation. The House is going to come up with its plan, and then the Senate's going to get to work on its version of how to reorganize healthcare in the U.S., at least for some segment of the population. And I think that's a smart place to just sort of watch. There's so much tension in Washington right now. These ideas that are getting bounced around, if you're a consumer and you're thinking about what's this going to mean for me, I think the best thing you can do is just like hold off. Do not get worked up about anything that you're hearing because this is all open for negotiation right now.
Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Zoom out a little bit now from healthcare to a broader look at the Trump administration's priorities for the government and the choices they'd like to make. Because that's what we got this week in the form of his first budget request. You've probably read or heard news stories about it, but it's really important to put any president's budget request in context. And for that, we turn to our Nancy Marshall Genzer in Washington. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, so let's take a step back here and explain what a federal budget request from the president is and what it is not, because that gets lost sometimes. Why don't you start us there?
Exactly. I mean, basically, Lizzie, this is a wish list from President Trump. Congress will take the Trump budget as pretty much a recommendation and write its own budget legislation that is a series of appropriations bills that fund the various agencies of the federal government. And if Congress wants to, it can ignore President Trump's budget entirely.
So let's take this as a wish list, as you're saying, you know, what he would like to do if given a blank slate. This is what's known in Washington as a skinny budget. Can you explain what that is to me?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, when a new president takes over, he or she is not expected to instantly come up with a big, fat, complete budget document, right? So you may have heard a couple weeks back, President Trump saying he wants to spend $54 billion on defense while cutting a similar amount from discretionary domestic programs. That was what's called a budget outline, very bare bones. This has a little bit more meat on it. It's kind of like a budget blueprint. And again, these are only submitted by new presidents. We're expecting President Trump's full budget later this spring, probably in May.
When we look at the skinny budget, there are some proposed cuts to federal agencies, and some of them are pretty big. Who gets hit the most?
Yeah, they are pretty big. But again, we're remembering this is just a wish list. So the EPA budget, it would be cut by almost a third. President Trump wants to get rid of more than 50 EPA programs. The State Department would be cut by more than 28%. There would be big cuts to foreign aid programs, grants to international development agencies like the World Bank. There would also be some cuts to the agriculture department. It would be cut by about 20%. You would see cuts at county offices, staff at county offices in rural areas. And President Trump would end a program that lets U.S. farmers donate crops for overseas food aid. Now, here's what's interesting, especially with those last budget cuts that I was talking about. President Trump would be cutting some programs that benefit rural voters, you know, some of his strongest supporters. And I talked about this with Sharon Parrott. She's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And she says President Trump wants to cut some programs that are very valuable to some of his strongest supporters.
For example, job training, something really important to a group of people that President Trump has set as a priority, people who are struggling in this economy. Job training sees very significant cuts in this budget and has been cut actually significantly over the last several years.
Nancy, one of the things that a budget request gets sort of analyzed for is how much it would cost the federal government. And we know that this is, as you say, a skinny budget request. So it's a little hard to run the numbers on that. But what do we know in terms of how this would or wouldn't add to the federal budget deficit?
You know, Lizzie, we know a lot less than we usually do at this point in a first president's first term. Trump's budget is especially skinny. It provides a lot less detail than the past five presidents' first budgets did.
Wow.
For example, Trump's budget only accounts for about a third of all federal spending. He doesn't count spending on entitlement programs like Medicare or Medicaid. So if you compare his budget with other first budgets from other presidents, it looks like he's spending a heck of a lot less, but actually he's just not counting spending on things like entitlements, which make up the bulk of the budget. Other presidents' skinny budgets included forecasts for taxes and spending. They explained what the effect of their budget would be on the deficit, and in some cases up to 10 years out. And here's more on that from Sharon Parrott.
The last five presidents have put out initial budgets that had information about revenues, about spending, and about deficits for at least 4 years, and some had them for as many as 10 years.
So we're putting all this stuff in some context now. If you're a listener trying to understand what this means for you, probably the best way to put it is, you know, Trump has served this ball to Congress with his list of priorities, things he likes, doesn't like, et cetera. What are the next steps?
Yeah, his budget goes to Congress. It already has. Congress takes a look and says, we're going to do what we want because Congress controls the purse strings and has the final say.
And is answerable to a variety of constituencies.
Exactly. And, you know, the interesting thing here is that, you know, members of both parties on Capitol Hill have already panned parts of President Trump's budget, been very upset with these cuts that are, you know, cuts to programs that are extremely popular with their constituents, things like job training. So we're already hearing some protests from Capitol Hill on this budget.
You know, Nancy, we're talking about Congress, but they don't actually have the best track record recently in terms of passing all the appropriations that make the federal government run, that give it money. So how do things look on that front?
Yeah, it's kind of discouraging. As I mentioned, Congress is supposed to pass appropriations bills every year that fund the various federal agencies that run the government. And it has to pass these appropriations bills one by one. So Congress was so divided, it was not able to do that for the fiscal year, fiscal 2017, which started back October 1st. We're running on what's called a continuing resolution, which basically just keeps funding levels at what they were the previous year.
And they just keep cutting themselves a check.
And the thing is, that most recent continuing resolution expires April 28th. And I can't believe I'm saying the S word, Lizzie, but we could have another government shutdown. But it is possible if Congress doesn't either extend the continuing resolution that we're operating under now or write a new one or actually pass those appropriations bills, the government's going to run out of money April 28th and parts of the government will shut down.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In addition to his proposed budget, President Trump signed an executive order this week to, quote, reorganize the federal government. According to the White House, the changes will make government more efficient, effective, and accountable. And yes, if this goes through, Trump's proposed cuts to the federal workforce would be historic. But a government reorganization is not unprecedented in recent history. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
The last time we saw an attempt to shrink the federal workforce this much was during the Clinton administration, when there was a 20% reduction.
That would be about 400,000 people.
Morley Winograd played a key role in this process as a policy director to Vice President Al Gore. One distinction, he says, Clinton's budget didn't seek outright cuts.
We looked for places where we could change the way the government functions and reduce headcount as a result of those changes.
Unlike President Trump, Winograd says the Clinton budget did not target specific agencies. Lindsay Kashgarian is research director at the National Priorities Project.
Another thing to notice is that those cuts were actually pretty short-lived.
Kashgarian says during the 1990s, the federal government benefited from a booming economy and significant drawdowns in defense spending.
But by the time you got to 1998, all of those cuts had actually been restored, and federal non-defense spending was back up to what it had been a few years earlier.
Heritage Foundation economist Steve Moore says cuts of 15% to 20% to some agencies should be doable, just as they were a few years ago under mandatory sequester cuts.
And it turned out that these agencies, when they were forced to, were able to suck in their stomachs and tighten their belts and become more efficient.
That's Marketplace's Adam Allington. Lens through which you can look at government priorities is, of course, immigration policy. The Trump administration has become more aggressive about deporting undocumented immigrants. Along the U.S.-Mexico border, one place receives more people who've been deported than any other: Tijuana. From our partners at the BBC, Juan Palier reports.
Alonso Delgadillo, known as El Norteño, is a graffiti artist who has lived here for 25 years. The fence has defined his art. His latest work is an image of a woman surrounded by swallows trapped in barbed wire.
Yo recientemente soy padre, pues tengo un hijo de tres meses.
I have a three-month-old son. My wife works in San Diego, and I work in Tijuana. In day-to-day life, I live in a kind of prison. We are separated, and the creature, our son, is like that swallow. He comes and goes, but he doesn't have a home right now. His place is the border. It's neither Tijuana nor San Diego.
Yo entiendo el pensamiento que estamos pidiendo cuando según sin documentos uno no tiene derechos.
Olmeca is a hip-hop artist who lives in the U.S. but has family on both sides of the border. For him, his music is a way of breaking barriers.
Because of my experiences growing up and knowing that my family members, in order to be with me, they're going to have to cross a border, potentially get arrested, I made the effort not to put borders and restrictions on my music.
He has relatives among the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants who live in the U.S. President Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric has left Olmeca dreading the prospect of his family breaking up.
So I had a family member that had to go into a government building, and from the moment that we got the scheduled date to the actual date, there was a lot of tension. There's a lot of arguments at home. Because why? Because of the fear that anything could happen to our families at any given moment.
If deported, his relative may end up in Tijuana. The city receives more deportees than any other along the border.
Hello, Sharon. This is Chris with the Vehicle Service Department.
This call center is giving criminals deported from the U.S. a second chance. Chris Ramirez speaks to customers in the States who have no idea gang-related tattoos cover his arms, chest, neck, and the back of his head.
I think about what I want to say in English, and then I have to translate it in my mind to be able to say it. And some words I can't even pronounce in Spanish, so that's really the reason why call centers have worked out for me.
And you say you have a Chevy Malibu now?
As a youngster, he got involved in gangs, guns, and drugs, spending his teenage years in jail. He was eventually given a choice: life behind bars in the country he called home, or freedom in the country he was born in. Chris doesn't even think of going back to his old life, but the new one hasn't been easy. This evangelical church housing Haitian migrants in the outskirts of Tijuana is both a shelter and a limbo. Christopher Faustin left Haiti after the earthquake that struck the country in 2010. Unable to enter due to an American policy aimed at dissuading more Haitians from migrating, thousands of them are stranded.
Ojalá México pudiera dar una oportunidad, porque
I wish Mexico could give us a chance, because if Mexico decides not to accept us, then it will be worse. Thank God it seems to me that Mexico is trying to legalize us. I think we are going to stay here in Mexico.
Christopher and his countrymen are the latest example of the stories that for decades have been part of this border town. Tijuana is a place of aspirations, of broken dreams, of new beginnings.
That was the BBC's Juan Pallier. Now, one of my favorite parts of the show, what we call the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight questions about work and money and what they've learned. And this one's for the indie music fans. Here's producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest.
Hi, I'm Connor Oberst. I'm a folk singer.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Whew, probably gym membership, you know? I mean, and you'd think that I don't go, but it's really because, like, I'm so naturally, like, buff that it's just, like, I don't need it. It's a waste of money.
Obviously.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it's like, clearly, I don't need to be gone here.
When did you realize that being a musician could be an actual career?
I've been playing music since I was, like, 13 years old, but I never thought of it. I was always like, well, you still got to go to college and you still have to go find a real job. And then I dropped out of college after like three semesters when I was 20 or something, and then started really touring full time. And even then I was like, okay, this is gonna like last a certain period of time and then I will have to get a real job. That was like 2000, was like Fevers and Mirrors, this Bright Eyes record we made, and then we made this one Lifted in like 2002. After that, it was kind of like apparent that people were going to pay me money to play music for a while. I don't know. So far, so good. So we'll see.
So do you still have that feeling in the back of your head like this might end anytime?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's getting weirder and harder for, you know, as everyone knows, for musicians to make a living. I'm very lucky, but...
Yeah, well, what do you mean by getting weirder?
Well, just no one pays for music anymore. You know, you can buy a t-shirt or you can go to a show, and that definitely helps. But no one really pays. You know, if you think about, like, the idea of, like, everyone paid, like, whatever, $10 for a record, and then however many records they bought a year, and now they pay $10 once and get all the records. So, like, the math doesn't, is not going to ever add up for the artist. The way I look at it is it's, like, a reflection of, like, the general economy where like the middle class is shrinking, so you'll have like huge superstars and then you'll have like a million baby bands that are like on Bandcamp and just like releasing their own stuff, which is great, but like the actual like middle class of musicians that like aren't like millionaires but they're like making the best music that needs to be made, that like have recording budgets and have like a little bit of promotion, like the kind of music I like, those artists are all like vanishing like fast, and that's, I think that's what's upsetting about the situation.
What is your most prized possession?
Okay, so there's this carousel horse that's in like the living room of my house that's like on a pole, you know, like sitting up there. It's from an old amusement park in Omaha called Pini Park, which has long been torn down. It used to be in my grandparents' house in their basement, and like when we were kids, we would always like sit on it and stuff. It has like an 80-pound weight limit, by the way, so if you come to my house, don't try to get on it. A lot of people do when they're drunk, but it was in their house, and then when they sold their house, my dad like took it out of there, and then when I finally bought my house that I live in, my dad kind of like surprised me and like put it up in my living room like when I was out of town. And I think that's probably my favorite like material possession I have, I guess.
What was your first job?
I was a janitor when I was like 15, and during the summer I was a janitor at Creighton University in Omaha. The Riggy Science Center is one of the buildings there. And I was a janitor for the summer, like mopping the floors and all that stuff. But there was like really no one there in the summer. So mostly like me and my couple of friends that worked there would like hide our mop buckets and then like eat acid and go to the student center and play video games. Yeah, that was a good way to make money.
Why'd you give that up?
I know. Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I should still be doing that. That'd be amazing.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
Well, I would say, you know, we kind of grew up in a weird little enclave subculture of like, you know, everything was like militant, like punk rock, indie rock, DIY culture. And so like as all our bands and our labels and all our friends got into the music industry, we like said no to like so much stuff. Mm-hmm. That now, and I think back, I'm like, man, why did I say no to that? I probably could be like more rich and famous if I hadn't like said no to a bunch of like things that were like easy to do. You know, at the time it felt like we were like sticking it to the man, but really it's like everyone's the man. We're living inside the man. You know, I'm not saying you should do like anything that makes you money if you don't, like if it's upsetting to your soul. It's like putting your song in a car commercial or something. It's like back in the day that was like so uncool, and now it's like when I hear my friend's songs in the car commercial, I'm like happy for them, you know. That means like M Ward's kids getting like nice Christmas presents this year, and like someone's buying a house somewhere, you know. Jim James has a new lawnmower now. So stuff like that, I feel like is like things that were maybe foolish back in my early career.
Conor Oberst's new album Salutations is out now.
Writing, singing every day. I'm on the clock. My mind races with all my longings, but can't keep up with what I got.
It has been a busy week in politics overseas. We are watching three key European elections and voters' choices in them. In the first, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte won the biggest number of seats in that parliament. And that's important because of a challenge from the far-right candidate Geert Wilders. The Dutch vote was seen as a test. Could that populist, anti-establishment backlash, which brought us Brexit and President Trump's victory, keep going? Well, Wilders did not do as well as many people thought he might. Joining us from the European desk in London, we've got Marketplace's Stephen Beard, who spent last week on the campaign trail in the Netherlands. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Lizzie.
So Geert Wilders did not do as well as many folks thought he was going to. What happened?
His program was very extreme. I mean, he was pledging to close all the country's mosques, ban the Quran, and pull out of the EU. And this in one of the most pro-EU and liberal and permissive countries in Europe. And the costings were described to me by a leading economist as completely ridiculous. So he was never going to get enough support from other parties to form a coalition and to govern. That said, he still came second and gained two seats, while the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, who won, lost eight seats. The key thing to say is that Wilders fell short of expectations. There was not the Wilders surge.
So if we pull back a little bit and try to put this in context with these other elections that you have covered and referenda in the EU, does this slow down this sort of anti-establishment, anti-EU
populist, if you want to use that word, bandwagon.
Yes, it certainly has slowed it down. I mean, we've got general elections coming up this year in France, Germany, possibly Italy too. And it's taken a little bit of the pressure off mainstream parties in those countries. French and German mainstream politicians have been jumping for joy since the results came out of the Dutch election. The French president said the result is a clear victory against extremism. The German chancellor's chief of staff was beside himself. He was tweeting, oh, the Netherlands, oh, the Netherlands, you are a champion. The next big test for this populist bandwagon is going to be in the French presidential election next month. And there, there's a much more formidable and popular contender, Marine Le Pen. So the bandwagon is wobbling, but it's still got its wheels on.
Can we look at this through a lens of Brexit and possibly to some degree Donald Trump? You know, did they play a part in Wilders' failure to do better than he did?
I heard Brexit and Trump mentioned a lot on the campaign trail in the Netherlands. Wilders himself has been widely described as the Dutch Trump. Wilders' supporters said, look, the Americans voted for Trump and the Brits voted for Brexit and the sky didn't fall in. So that's an encouragement. But I heard many more people, particularly citing Brexit, as a reason for not supporting Wilders. There's very little appetite in the Netherlands for Euroscepticism, for pulling out of the EU.
Well, on the British Brexit vote, this was a big week. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, won parliamentary approval to trigger the exit negotiations, but then she didn't do it. So we're sort of in this middle spot. What's going on there?
Well, the Prime Minister May is committed to triggering Article 50 before the end of March. And it'll be astonishing if she doesn't do that. There's terrific momentum in the UK now for Brexit. But I think she hesitated this week because she was rather thrown off balance by Nicola Sturgeon, the head of the devolved government of Scotland, who announced that because a majority of Scots had voted to stay in the EU, she now wants to have another referendum on Scottish independence. Here's what she had to say.
I believe that it would be wrong for Scotland to be taken down a path that it has no control over, regardless of the consequences for our economy, for our society, for our place in the world, for our very sense of who we are as a country.
She says she wants Scotland to leave the UK so it can remain in the EU. And she says she wants to hold that second independence referendum in about 18 months' time before Britain Brexits.
Scotland was very much, and you hear it in Nicola Sturgeon's voice, supportive of the EU. They would like to stay in. Does that pave the way for a UK breakup? Are we looking at, you know, real fractions within the United Kingdom?
Yes, we certainly could be. Support for independence in Scotland has grown since the last independence referendum 2.5 years ago, although the economic case has actually deteriorated. With the sharp fall in the price of oil, Scotland now depends on transfers from the rest of the UK worth more than $10 billion a year. Whether or not there is a referendum and when depends very much on Theresa May. And she has made it clear she's not keen on one, and certainly not before she's concluded Brexit.
Right now, we should be working together, not pulling apart. We should be working together to get that right deal for Scotland, that right deal for the UK. As I say, that's my job as Prime Minister. And so for that reason, I say to the SNP, now is not the time.
Brexit on its own is going to be tough enough. May doesn't want to fight on another front at the same time.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
If you've taken an Uber or a Lyft lately, one thing you probably didn't take was a taxi. And here in New York, which is hard to picture without yellow cabs, taxi ridership has dropped nearly 30% in the past 3 years. And that's really hard for people who own taxi medallions, the metal plaques that permit someone to drive a cab. Marketplace's Mariel Segura has the story.
On 8th Avenue in Manhattan, Kudratullah Saberi is sitting in the driver's seat of his cab across the street from a hotel.
I'm waiting here since 12 o'clock. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes. There's no job.
Saberi, who's 63, says driving a cab used to earn him $500 a day. Now, he says he often makes half that. He nods his head toward a stream of taxis whizzing by.
You see that? The taxi, most of them empty.
Saberi owns the cab he's driving, and its taxi medallion. He bought it for about $300,000 in 2012. Its value spiked, and he borrowed against it. Now, with two kids to support, one in college, plus his housing costs, he's not sure he'll be able to make his loan payment this month.
I'm short about $1,000.
New York City started selling taxi permits, later called medallions, around the turn of the 20th century. They gave drivers the exclusive right to pick up passengers who hail them on the street. Medallion owners could drive a cab or lease one out, taking a cut of the profits. With no competition, yellow taxis were guaranteed to bring in a steady stream of fares. Michael Wallows is a spokesperson for the taxi advocacy group, the Metropolitan Taxi Cab Board of Trade. He says that made the medallion valuable.
It outpaced every index on the stock market. I mean, it was a solid investment.
Medallion prices trended up over time. In 1947, they cost about $2,500. By mid-2013, people were paying just over $1 million to buy one. Medallions for fleet owners cost even more. Wallows says someone could buy a medallion and cash out for retirement, and medallions could be used as collateral to buy a home, send kids to college, open a business.
It really allowed so many people in New York, particularly immigrants that built something from nothing, to put the building blocks in place so that they can keep moving up and up and up the ladder.
Banks saw these collateralized loans as low risk. Mira Zoshi is the commissioner of the city's Taxi and Limousine Commission.
It was this sort of faith in the market never changing that I think led the banks to have lots of confidence.
Enter Uber. It came to New York in 2011. Medallions are now selling for as little as $400,000, many in foreclosure sales, far less than their peak values. And a lot of medallion owners aren't making enough money to pay back their loans.
And they've come to us asking for relief.
Robert Familant is the CEO of Progressive Credit Union. 85% of its loans involve taxi medallions. The credit union's allowing some borrowers to pay what they can afford for now. That'll probably mean taking some losses.
But that's the economics of our current circumstance. And that's the best way to keep our members owning the medallions, paying on their loans.
Medallion owners argue that Uber and Lyft impinge on a taxi's rights without having to follow the same regulations. 58-year-old Nino Hervias is a taxi driver and owes about $540,000 on his medallion loan. He argues there's essentially no difference between hailing a cab and requesting a car through Uber.
At the millisecond that you press that button, you're calling the attention of the driver as if you were on the street raising your hands.
State courts have ruled otherwise, saying ride-sharing apps offer prearranged rides, like black cars. Uber spokesman Matt Wing says the app has expanded access to neighborhoods that were underserved by taxis, and that's more important than worrying about the price of the medallion.
Because ultimately, all that does is serve the interests of banks and medallion owners.
In Manhattan, as Kudratullah Saberi waits for someone, anyone, to flag him down, he tells me he's thinking about filing for bankruptcy this summer. As for his future?
I have no retirement. I think the rest of my life I go to welfare.
Saberi says at this point, his medallion is just a piece of metal. In New York, I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
And that's our show for this week. Remember, you can always come talk to me or the team at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Harshman with help from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.